Crowded tonight?
Oh, yes, always crowded.
Some people got the dough, thousands are starving.
Yeah, that's the truth. Lots of them folks in there's hungry, too. They're starving.
What else can you starve for except food?
Oh, lots of things. Maybe they don't know just what it is. Most all them folks are starving for something. And it ain't just food. They comes in here and eats and dances around and hugs herself up to a woman. For a while, they think they're happy. Then he comes out, and the old world is just as cold and empty as it was before. That's real starving, Mr. Rye.
Why, Tim, you're a philosopher.
Yes, I.
Okay, are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Cue the appropriate music. No, no, no. I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
And thank you very much, Michael H. Price, the only man I know who is certified to perpetrate existentialism and does so on a regular basis. It's very nice to visit with you again, Michael.
Nice racket we got here, eh?
Well, you know, it beats working, doesn't it? Well, you know, this time we're talking about a film called Night World. And I did a little bit of research on it, and it's almost a forgotten picture in a lot of ways. It's one of the pictures that Boris Karloff did following Frankenstein.
Kind of and marking time the studio, until they could find the right next vehicle, yeah.
Yeah, and I think it was it not going to be The Invisible Man? Wasn't that what they were planning?
Karloff was docketed for properties right and left, some of which actually got made, some of which actually got made with him. He was to have been the title player in The Invisible Man, which of course went to Claude Rains.
Yes.
Karloff was destined to be in The Mummy, which was originally going to be a film called Cagliostro, about the soothsayer, the prognosticator,
right,
the court magician. And somehow that got folded into the film that became The Mummy, which is about this deathless spirit traveling through the ages and causing mayhem wherever he lights. My favorite unproduced Karloff was to be, just in concept alone, it sounds fascinating, was to be Bluebeard.
Yes.
Which got deep sixed when Edgar Ulmer got caught dallying with one of his producer's wives.
Was it Sidney Fox, or am I getting all that wrong?
No, that was Mrs. Alexander, one of the wife of one of the founder's nephews.
Well, Sidney Fox got into it with somebody, and I can't remember who she did, but,
it's hard to tell
the players
right
on a scorecard.
That's a good one.
In between The Mummy and Night World was, of course, Old Dark House, if I'm not mistaken.
Old Dark House, which was, of course, the intended to be the perfect follow-through to Frankenstein, to the point of even giving Karloff a mystery billing, and
yes,
then later reassuring the audience that this is the same guy that creeped you out in Frankenstein.
Well, the forgotten picture in all of this, in Karloff's early pre-code having fangs,
pre-Legion of Decency. I love that name.
The Legion of Decency.
Such nasty people to have such a nice name.
But they were decent people, Michael.
They were decent people. We must remember that.
That's right. And, of course, we don't want to go into this deeply, but 1934 was really when the Legion of Decency aligned itself with the production code and things really got clamped down.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But,
yeah,
you know, in this film, you know it's before that era, less than a minute into the opening montage, don't you? I mean,
it pretty well tests the threshold.
It does.
A very dark, not to give away too much, but right down to the ending, which takes a bit of a hopeful twist that's not altogether out of character with the darkness of the film, but it still comes off as this is the kind of film that David Lynch, in fact, he's cited Night World in interviews that I've done with him. He's cited Night World as one of the influences upon the style we associate with David Lynch.
Really?
The seamy underbelly of polite society. And, of course, Prohibition was a time when nothing really was prohibited if you could get away with it.
Right. In other words, since alcohol was banned and everybody was drinking alcohol, then whatever was banned was fair game as well.
That's exactly right. And the minute you ban something, you make it popular. You can't have this.
Although this is kind of a stretch in my interviews with Leon Russell. He's talked about the days in the 50s. Of course, Oklahoma was not a liquor by the drink state until much later, but
way
playing
later.
The illicit clubs in Tulsa as a high schooler. I mean, he said because they were flouting the law anyway, anything goes. And so they might play 8-hour shows until 4 a.m. and then try and come in and, you know, sit through English class in high school in Tulsa. But this is the same thing. And everybody in this picture, I mean, there's adultery. There's a gay character in the picture. There's all sorts of things that make this film seem more contemporary than it really is.
And you have a very wise narrator, or kind of a one-man Greek chorus, who is a black guy.
Exactly what I was going to ask
common,
you about.
Not
Clarence
common.
Muse is the Greek chorus, isn't he?
Yes. Dr. Muse, the one of two guys who played the coach driver in White Zombie. Muse didn't know how to drive a coach, so they hired not quite a look-alike. You can tell the difference. Muse was all over the place. He shows up. You can trace his career from the way early years of talking pictures.
Yes.
The earliest years of talking pictures, not much in the silence, but from the time he shows up as the father of Farina Hoskins in an Our Gang comedy, that would be 1929. I mean, there's no stopping Clarence Muse, and he was a kind of an aristocratic
presence in the black acting community. Was he not?
Never played the buffoon. Occasionally would touch on the kind of edgier side of class and color humor. For example, he's the butler in Invisible Ghost with Bela Lugosi,
yes.
who has a bit of a fright and turns to the gardener, a white guy, and says with a straight face, "Do I look pale?" And that's the kind of testing that color bar gag that completely grates against the watermelon grin of, say, Step and Fetch It.
Right.
And a progressive fellow. Muse held a doctorate, and I'm sure I have seen somewhere what that doctorate was in, but very scholarly fellow, great musician, great singer, operatic baritone bass, and he shows up as late as Black Stallion, the 1979 Black Stallion,
right?
And in Car Wash of all things,
yes, and in Night World, he functions as a kind of a Greek chorus, a narrator. There's a line that he has in there that I think kind of encapsulates the whole thing. And I should say he plays the doorman at this nightclub, and this whole film takes place in one after-hours night into the morning at the club run by Boris Karloff. And Muse says, "Mighty funny world. The wrong people always like the wrong people."
Yes.
And that is really, he is the person, I mean, he's a philosopher in this and all this, even though he's ultimately a tragic figure. He still is the one who I think is almost the overwhelming. Now, Karloff is very good in it, and even George Raft, who's way down in the billing, makes a pretty good impression too. But boy, Clarence Muse is just all over this picture.
Mm-hmm.
And from the very first, there is an atmosphere of doom in Night World. And no one in Night World, except maybe Mae Clark, is particularly sympathetic. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, even the nominal protagonist, Lou Ayres, of course, this was before he got all wholesome with Dr. Kildare, but he still looks a bit too fresh in the face to be debauched, frankly, debauched, I think.
Debauched, yeah.
Uh-huh, yeah. This, and then, of course, the setting is one of those bad places that everybody wants to go to, but nobody wants to be caught in.
Right. And yet there's that wonderful atmosphere of forced gaiety in it that I really love. And
correct.
Also all of the storylines. There's a number of storylines in this picture.
There are. The first time I watched it, I was watching it for Karloff, plain and simple.
Of course.
And he's got a good story. The proprietor, with the rather ironic name of Happy.
Where are you going?
Out.
Out where?
Just out. After what's happened tonight, you don't think I'm going to stick around here, do you?
I do.
Well, think again, Big Shot. You and I are quits.
Oh, no, we are not. If you think I'm going to let you go to Klaus, you're crazy. I'm going to keep you here to make you sweat and like it. And I'm going to poke you, see, every time you look at another guy. It'll be just like sitting on the hot seat, not knowing when the juice is coming on. And there won't be any divorce, baby, until I want to get it.
That's right.
Which, like, well, how did you get that nickname, I wonder? Sounds like a little forced irony to me. of course, it's a matter of juggling stories, all leading to a big showdown. Of course, the thought just occurred to me, this is the ideal picture to watch for anyone who's been following Boardwalk Empire on HBO.
Really?
The Prohibition angle.
Uh-huh.
And which, of course, that's a Martin Scorsese production, and needless to say, it captures the time period with great accuracy. Night World is, Hobart Henley was a master juggler, and yet by 1934, 2 years after Night World, his career as a director was over and done with.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, perhaps it had something to do with the fact, and, you know, we're seeing this film, what, 80 years after it was made?
Well, along.
And a little over 80 years, I guess, actually. And, you know, I don't want to be revisionist about it, but it's pretty brilliant in its depiction of that Prohibition era, again, forced gaiety, if I can use that term.
Definitely,
You know, and
Prohibition was still on while the picture was in progress.
I'm sorry, during Prohibition, right,
yes.
Right. And it seems, you know, it's not really a message picture, but it does seem to have something to say about debauchery is the term that you used, or it just these people don't really seem to be having a good time.
No, they have nothing to lose.
Well, that's, good point.
And they're not really seeking pleasure so much as they're seeking, I think, some kind of an exit, even if it means somebody gets croaked.
Right, which, of course, does happen in the course of the picture.
Yeah, not to spill too many beans.
Exactly.
Exactly.
But Mae Clark is great in this, and the Busby Berkeley sequences, which he has said that it was just a minor job for him, but he needed the money, and so he came in. And those are, boy, straight out of those Warner Brothers musicals, his geometric dancing and all of that, even though he's doing it on a small budget. I found that part of it to be really interesting.
The radial compositions of the dance sequence also carry over into the radial compositions of the confrontation scenes.
Yes.
To the point where you really feel like you're watching a almost a Germanic expressionist picture, Of course, you know, the Lemley family, the whole Universal operation was directly descended from the German Expressionist cinema of the Weimar Republic, and you're going to see that kind of radial composition, which gives the illusion of turmoil as if in a revolving spiral. And Busby Berkeley, of course, translated that Germanic symbol of madness or chaos into some of the jolliest scenes of gaiety you'll ever run across. Like, there's something dark going on here, and I kind of like it.
That's true. That's exactly right. And he was, this was just kind of a contract job, but Mae Clark acquits herself very well. You don't think of her as a dancer, but she does a nice job in it. But
Dorothy
even
Rivière,
with the dancing, there's that whole behind-the-scenes thing about how, you know, strenuous and not fun that it really is.
Correct. The backstage setting, kind of like James Cruise's picture of a few years earlier, the Great Gabo with Eric von Stroheim.
Yes, great picture.
Backstage hustle and bustle that looks like it's not really all that fun to put on a show.
And every, just it looks like the entertainment business isn't that much fun. I mean, Boris Karloff's character, Happy McDonald, his Mrs. Mac, Dorothy Reaver, is having an affair with the dance instructor, the dance director. And then the whole thing with Lou Ayres is around an alleged adulterous affair with his folks. And the whole thing is just sort of shot through with a kind of seediness that I find pretty bracing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, it's like, you know, there's a lot of drinking to forget.
Yes, that's
which,
right.
Which is like, where did you get the idea that that would work? and you get a combination, as you said, of storylines that link up pretty darn well. I mean, it's not a long or overly complicated film. Runs less than an hour, as I recall.
Yes, about 60 minutes, right.
And it really covers those bases, the scandalous behavior, the desperate confrontations, the illicit relationships. I love Hedda Hopper. She should have stayed an actress and stayed away from the celebrity gossip.
Right.
Very, very stuffy image that she projects there. And, of course, George Raft shows up.
George Raft is very, very billed, very, very far down in the cast.
Yeah, almost a cameo, and yet he registers. The presence
is undeniable.
And I think
Scarface came out that same year, didn't it?
I believe that's right.
And made him a star all of a sudden with the same basic portrayal.
Yeah.
And Hedda Hopper, we should point out, plays Lou Ayres' mother.
Mother, yeah.
Who is really one of the least in a film full of people who are not very appealing. She may be the least of the bunch. And what a wonderful portrayal it is. She's so brittle and so so detached, and it's an amazing portrayal. You're right. I mean, she might have done very well as a character actor had she stayed in that instead of going into the gossip business.
Oh yeah, yeah, and she shows up not a great many, but she shows up in some of the more significant titles in the Forgotten Horrors books.
That's right. She certainly does. Yeah, I'd forgotten about that, but that's right. She had a pretty nice career as a third or fourth or fifth billed actress in movies,
and stayed at it into the 60s off and on.
Well, I guess that's true. Yeah, she has still enjoyed showing up, didn't she? You know, would you recommend this picture, Michael?
Oh, I would not only recommend it, I'd go back and see it a few more times over the long haul.
Yeah, me too. I hadn't seen it for a couple of years when we decided to do this. And,
you can't go wrong with Universal.
Really
Can't go wrong with Universal. We have discovered some of the most obscure Universals during this program, the run of the program. My favorite unknown Universal is still Cross Country Cruise, another Lou Ayres picture.
Lou Ayres that was all over the place, wasn't he? And
yeah,
it was mostly
yeah.
in the B pictures, I guess.
Yeah, he...
Quiet on the Western Front, I mean.
Quiet on the Western Front. And then, of course, his true level was more of the shirt sleeves hero.
Mm-hmm.
I like him in the Dr. Kildare pictures. People tend to think that, you know, Dr. Kildare, well, that's soap opera. That's too wholesome to watch. A lot of good things going on, including some great comedy relief in the support. Mike Mazurki. Red Skelton in
Red
some of the
Skelton.
Supporting. Yeah, uh-huh. exactly. A splendid batch of performances, and of course Lionel Barrymore as Dr. Gillespie, the grouchy senior surgeon, just lords it over Lou Ayres. So mild title role player, very likable. I prefer Ayres' pre-war work, such as Night World.
And
but
of course,
but you can't
go wrong.
Front. All Quiet on the Western Front, definitely. And
you know, I have a kind of a soft spot in my heart for Donovan's Brain.
Oh, yeah. That's a classy picture, isn't it?
Well, it's an entertaining picture anyway.
And really,
so is Night World. And I don't know, I got the print that we watched, I got from a friend years and years ago. Of course, you transferred it from VHS to DVD for us so we could watch it. But do you know if it's in any sort of general release, if people want to pick it up and see it?
Not to my knowledge, but one is advised to look on the more obscure websites.
Mm-hmm.
I've never looked to see. You know, there's been a lot of Universal box sets on DVD and Blu-ray, digital video and all that, but they always seem to leave something out.
Right.
You know, they'll do a box set of Universal's great Mad Doctor pictures, and then they'll leave out one of the Captive Ape Woman pictures.
Right. Right.
it's kind of maddening, and of course, needless to say, there is no MCA Universal DVD Presents Night World. You can't just pop on Amazon.com and that reminds me. There is a pair of good video sites. Everybody knows about YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't looked at that to see if Night World is. Looks to me like Night World may be sitting right there on YouTube.
Night World
at least,
on YouTube, huh?
Except apparently not in complete form. My source for the web viewing probably would be archive.org, which is...
Well, we'll have our producer check. Our producer, Joey
yes.
Hambrick, I think...
But I'm pretty sure you can find the complete Night World in a decent print on a web catalog called lovingtheclassics.com.
Lovingtheclassics.com, okay.
Yeah, they run
well,
a little slow sometimes.
As long as we're plugging things, let's plug what the next thing that the Protean Michael Price has on the market. What's the latest?
Working on the latest volume of comics from the Gone World.
Good.
The title is a mouthful, so I'll take it real slow. The book is called Journey into Weird Mysteries of Strange Fear, which is another spoof on the Iger Shop comics
of course,
of the 1950s. Finally getting around, in fact, I just hit the halfway mark on the manuscript to doing the expanded first American edition of Dance of the Peckerwoods.
Mm-hmm. Which
the
you
Texas
might tell
music.
Folks is your exploration of Texas music.
Yes. We're going to change the title, however.
Mm-hmm. I kind of like Dance of the Pecorines.
I like
That's
it
great.
Fine.
The
but,
book, too, by the way.
But I need to distinguish it from the British edition. I should hasten to add that a Peckerwood is a rural white denizen of the Southland.
Right.
You don't hear the term very often. Anyway, we're changing the title for the first American edition. It will now be called, with apologies to Joe Mafis, Thick Lights, Loud Smoke, and Dim, Dim Music.
Is that coming out from Cremo?
That will be coming out under the Cremo Studios imprint, yeah.
All right, very good. How are we coming on that Forgotten Horrors 7?
That's coming along right well. It's kind of running apace with the two books I just mentioned.
Great.
And, gosh, I've got your stuff about ready to fold into the appropriate period of time.
Well, I should mention that the comics from the Gone World, which just tickle me to death, we were talking at the first of the show, or I introduced you as the man who has sartrified to perpetrate existentialism, and there's plenty of existentialism being perpetrated in the comics from the Gone World, as well as a lot of police and donut jokes, which juxtaposed just make for some pretty fine reading, if you don't mind my saying so.
That's kind of the point. I think you may be one of five people in the world who really get it. But hey, you know, one of the objectives of telling stories is that you really want to leave a certain percentage of your audience scratching their heads and say, "What?"
Right, right. Well, I have to say, Michael, that since we last convened for this little shindig. And I have a new book out on Amazon called Ed Galloway's Totem Pole Park.
Yeah.
It's the biography and the story of a roadside attraction here in my part of the country, the world's largest man-made totem pole. As I tell people, that's as opposed to the world's largest naturally occurring totem pole. But it's a short book, it's a small book, under $10, and the man who made this, it's one of those great stories of someone who just wanted to do something and did it. And in this case, it was Ed Galloway, who after he retired decided he would build the biggest totem pole in the world. And he built it himself, mixed a bucket of cement himself, each bucket, and built about 10 feet a year until it was done. So it's a pretty fascinating story. If anybody's interested in looking at it or looking more into it, it's just went on Amazon. Michael, are you there?
Yeah, right here.
All right, very good. And so you'll have a little cut there. I missed Michael. So, all right. Okay, you got it? Okay, very good. So I think then that will call a halt to this dandy. We look like we're about in the right time frame, and we seem to be getting more and more people listening to the podcast, and we want to just say thank you to
That's
those who are discovering us for the first time, and we're happy you're along. Cost nothing to play.
Most grateful for the listening.
Absolutely,
always
right.
A pleasure.
Yeah.
And we'll be talking to you soon. And on behalf of myself and my producer standing over our producer standing over my shoulder, Joey Hambrick, thank you for listening to the Forgotten Horrors podcast. We'll be back before you know it.
He's been here three nights in a row, plastered.
Yeah, he's still fighting the same jag, poor kid. Haven't I seen his picture in the papers?
Yeah, the Wren case.
Oh, yes, his mother killed his father.
Yeah, in the other woman's apartment.
There's old Papa Goldberg again. Yeah, and the more he comes here, the lower he gets. My husband will be glad to see you. Hello, baby.
Mr. Baby to you.
My baby.